Douglas demanding his part be put back in. I swear I was in that movie. I swear I was. Was Bill Hicks in that test audience?
Goat Boy called it like he saw it, Mikey.
Horrible film. Just like Madonna's sex book, all it's meant to do is titillate a completely neutered and docile fucking consumer community, which we have become. What do people say about that film? It's great. Why? You get to see Sharon Stone's pussy. Ooh, the hallmark of art. Yeah, you get to see her pussy for 1/8 of a second. I timed it. Don't blink, you might miss the plot. That's how bad this film is. 40 minutes into it, you're going, what a piece of shit. She goes... Did you see her pussy? No, I was reaching for my Coke. What happened? Dude, you missed it, man. We gotta watch this again. This could be the greatest film all year. God, are we that fucking neutered? Maybe you don't know this. Maybe you know there's movies you can rent. Nothing but pussy. Did y'all know that? Swear to God, 1/8 of a second of plot, the rest of the film, pussy. The numbers are exactly reversed.
And coming up next on Free Radio, Bathrob Spears Broadsides, 2 hours of civil rights, or chatter about it in any case. Join in and stay with us at 101.1 FM. Today is the 9th of June.
Santa Clara. McDonald's parking lot, surrounded by four police cruisers, while two bigs in SWAT gear search your car illegally, and a third one frisks you. And now I'm not talking about no pussy little frisk like you see in front of a club. I'm talking about a real motherfucking frisk like they do on cops when they tell you to spread your legs, put your hands on the hood of the car, and they pat you down so good you think you're getting a hand job. And you know, if they don't find nothing on you, if they don't find nothing on you, oh shit, look out downtown, cause somewhere someone's getting arrested for being brown in downtown. Someone's getting beat to a pulp by Billy Clubs in a back alley for being brown in downtown. Someone's getting shot for being brown in downtown. And everywhere, 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 rest is going down for being brown in downtown.
And that was Greedo Serpentino, Downtown, an old theme song that I'm just bringing back. Well, I like it, and there it is. You're tuned to Free Radio 101.1, also www.freakradio.org. I'm Robert North, and this is Bathrob Spears Broadsides. And looks like we got a phone call even as we speak. Let's see who's on the line. Hi, you're on Free Radio. Hello? Hello?
Hi, Robert.
Yeah, you're on the air.
This is Reva.
Hey, Reva.
And I do have a few minutes. Is this a possible time for you? This is a bad connection, but...
Oh, no, I mean, you're live right now, and why not go ahead? We're talking with Reva Entine, who's an activist up in Berkeley fighting to open up KPFA and other Pacifica radio stations. Is that accurate?
That's accurate, to the listeners, which is what it's all about. Yes, thank you.
I know we spoke a couple weeks ago trying to get Bill Mandel back, trying to make sure that other people fired in the past get access, trying to democratize procedures at KPFA. What's been happening?
Well, we have a victory to celebrate. It does appear that Bill Mandel will be on the air this Sunday at 6:30. That's KPFA 94.1 FM, 6:30 to 7 in the evening, right after the evening news. It'll be a half an hour, the second 15 minutes of which will be listener call-ins. And this is a 10-year struggle. He was banned from the station, and through the effort of people not giving up, this 88-year-old brilliant political mind is going to be speaking to the listeners again.
You can actually check out his, he has a website, and he's written a book saying no to power, right?
Yes. Yes, he stood up to HUAC, he has stood up to the power of the state, and he is also a Sovietologist. He was an expert on the Soviet Union. And he'll also, his first show, he'll be talking to a woman who he said literally knows 4,000 people in Russia currently, and she also studies the people there, and he said it's an effort to bridge the gap between the two countries to avoid nuclear holocaust.
KPFA, I think, is carried here in Santa Cruz either on KUSP or KZSC, the regular evening news. I don't know. This isn't the evening news we're talking about. It's a special show, right?
Correct. It follows the evening news, but it is a special show.
And
People can also listen on the web, though, at www.kpfa.org.
Oh, that should be helpful.
But there's other stuff that's lively, so I just wanted to jump in here, and then I got to go to a meeting, actually, to prepare for listeners getting involved, because we do have governing boards, which unfortunately have been largely dominated by people supporting the staff who don't want much to change, and once again, it takes the people, it takes listeners to be actively involved. Two things specifically. One is, I might have talked about it last time, that there was an incident where immediately following the Bill Mandel vote at the program council, a staff member who voted the other way got so outraged that he threw four metal chairs around the room, hitting one person. The general manager was there, and nothing of consequence at all happened to the employee who did this.
Hmm.
What you don't know, Robert, is a few days later there was another incident in which the general manager and another employee nearly came to blows. They stepped out to duke it out. So the level of violence and threat of violence at the workplace, I believe, is unprecedented.
Hmm.
And at the last monthly board meeting in Berkeley, there were listeners there who said, we want to hear what is happening to assure a safe workplace, which, of course, is guaranteed by law. And the board asked people to leave in order to go into executive session. And there was a near sit-in at a KPFA board meeting, which might be a first for KPFA.
People.
It was about 12 people refused to leave.
And did the board go ahead with its meeting? What happened?
Well, what happened is I brokered a deal, which I said, and it was an informal agreement, but I said, can we agree to put a public discussion of violence at the workplace on our next agenda for our next meeting? And people agreed, nodding their heads, said yes. I asked, does anybody disagree? And nobody disagreed. And on that basis, the public left. Well, guess what? Now everybody's saying it didn't happen, or that's not really what had happened, and they are saying, this is my fellow board members, most of them are saying, we're not going to talk about it in public session. So the next meeting is this coming Saturday, the day before Bill Mandel is going to be on the air, at 11 o'clock in Freight and Salvage in Berkeley, Addison, and San Pablo. And if they don't allow the public to have a discussion with the board about what we can do to guarantee a safe workplace, can I say all hell might break loose?
Oh, this is free radio. You can only say all heck on free radio.
Heck.
Yeah, all heck might break
loose.
We want to be, watch our language.
That's the immediate thing in terms of KPFA.
Well, let me ask you this. You've talked to other board members informally. Why are they was this recorded, this agreement you had? Was it audioed or videoed?
Good question. The station is supposed to be webcasting, actually, so all you guys should be able to hear it. They haven't done so. Indie Media actually videotaped it, and we do have it on video. The audio tape that the station made turned it off at that point, coincidentally, so there's no official record of it, so they're denying that it happened.
Aha, so next time you'll be carrying your own little tape recorder with you, right?
Yeah. Right. And, you know, one of the things that they're using is the excuse. There's all sorts of ways they can use things to shield from the public eye, like, more things go into executive session than should be. And they're saying, well, this is a personnel matter. Well, it's not a personnel matter if listeners and staff are afraid to go into the station for fear of a metal chair being hurled at them.
Well, what have you talked to any members? How many members were on the board when this matter was referred to?
25.
There was how many, 12 members of the public or 12 members of the board refused to leave, or a mixture?
I mean, the room was filled with about 50 listeners, but there were about 12 who were prepared to get arrested.
And were any board members prepared to be part of that?
Well, we didn't have to leave, so we couldn't have gotten arrested. We had the right to be there, you know.
Right, okay.
Right.
Well, have you talked to any other board members to get some clue as to what the rationale is? It simply are they standing by their belief that this is a personnel matter and hence not appropriate for public discussion, or is there some other excuse they're using? What's the deal?
Well, that's one of the excuses, and then the other excuse is an outright lie that it didn't happen, that we never agreed to it. Or, for example, that we should have a town hall meeting to discuss it. It's like, okay, yes, both. We promised to have it on this coming agenda, and yes, we should have a town hall meeting about the violence, frankly, throughout the network. But at this point, like I said, at KPFA, I think it's unprecedented.
Wow. And does this indicate to you that the same kind of problems that prompted, well, I guess a lockout and a strike and the expulsion of Democracy Now! From Amy Goodman, I mean, from KPFA, as well as, of course, Mandel's exclusion back in the mid-90s, and then the firing of what? Over how many people were fired back then?
About 100.
Is the same process actually? Is the same gang still in charge?
Or? It is the same in gang. The term is the entrenched staff, and what many people say is that the entrenched staff, the people who were there way back in the bad old days, are the ones who collaborated with the hijackers, and the hijackers are the ones who are trying to sell the network to the highest bidder, basically.
And again, for full disclosure purposes, is there any contrary arguments or website discussions where people are, say, are denouncing you, Reva Entine, as a troublemaker, of spreading false information?
Probably, let me know. There were two different slates that ran for the board this last time. The one that I support generally, which I believe has the listener's interest in mind, is People's Radio. I think it's .net on the web. The other one, whether they still maintain their website or not, I don't know at this point, but it was called KPSA Forward.
So for folks who might want to sniff around at KPFA Forward to get some contrary views, if...
Yeah, and actually, indie media, you know, with these threads and stuff, you can find people saying all sorts of things. I can't give you the direct link, but it's the SF Bay indie media has been having comments pretty regularly these days.
How can people support a more open process at KPFA other than simply coming, sitting down, bringing the entire, I don't know, media with them? I mean,
let me get back to that as a final bit, because let me just tell you the other little piece that I need to run to actually plan for what I'm about to tell you, which is that KPFA is one of five stations in the network. There's a national board, Pacifica National Board, which meets quarterly, and the board is made up of elected representatives of the five stations. That board is meeting in in Berkeley for the first time in a year. It's our turn, and it's the weekend of June 17th, 18th, and 19th. That's a Friday, Saturday, Sunday at the Doubletree Hotel at the Berkeley Marina. And some of the problems we're having at KPFA are occurring throughout the network, such as refusal to turn over financial documents. I talked on the air with you last time about Robert Knight's firing. That still is not resolved. There's actually a watering down of what I consider, and many people consider, a watering down of our hard-hitting political programming. So that weekend is a weekend that people might want to swing by and enjoy Berkeley. What's helpful is to listen in, to whatever extent your listeners can listen in, and listener call-ins. Some shows have listener call-ins, and what I think it's time to do is, regardless of what's being talked about, people should call in and voice their opinion. What is happening with violence at the station? What is happening with the KPFA news? Why does it sound like it comes off the AP-UPI wire? People should utilize the airwaves and call in and voice their outrage, if you have it, at what's happening, because it is our station, and we need to be sure it remains ours, and at this point, I believe we need to reclaim it.
Are you still putting out your newsletter? We're speaking with Reva.
It's going out tomorrow morning.
Okay, and again, for people to get in touch with you, they should go to...
Yeah, the website is www.struggleandwin.net, and it's dashes between, so struggle-and-win.net.
Wow. Thanks, Reva. Anything you want to add?
No, that's good. Thanks for doing it. Thanks for getting on me to get back to you. Sorry it took so long.
Hey, good luck at the meeting.
Thanks. Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye. And again, Free Radio is what you're tuned to. That was Reva Entine. Activist puts out Confidential, sort of an online zine report. It's not really a zine. It's just a newsletter about KPFA. KPFA has been a news source of mine for decades, and I've watched it deteriorate, and it's depressed me. But although, of course, it's also prompted the rise of independent so-called pirate or free radio stations, such as the one you're listening to now, Free Radio Santa Cruz. In fact, the flag, the flagship station, is that the word, in Berkeley, Free Radio Berkeley, began because of the KPFA policies that were essentially excluding meaningful local coverage, harassing those in the studio who are trying to press for more representation for dissident points of view and local points of view and non-corporate points of view, even at a listener-supported station like KPFA. And you can hear it down here. KPFA is, of course, broadcast at webcast at www.kpfa.org, and I believe it also comes out over KUSP or KZSC, and somebody has specific times on that they can, although I think it's only the KPFA news that comes out then. Anyway, if you want to get in touch here, you can call in. The phone lines is open at 972-427-3772, or you can go to the chat room at pagesincolor.com, which is what I am doing, opening up the old chat room, and you can ask a question, make a comment, grumble, grunt, whatever feels good to you, and I will keep an eye on what's happening. Having a little trouble with my email, so I'm kind of a little bit handicapped tonight, but I'm working on it anyway. I brought in some printed out notes, which I'm going to use instead of the usual emailed schedule that I use to kind of run through, and I'm sure it'll do fine. Here's a little something from the street, and maybe we'll hear something from you folks out there. And now some music on the mall in front of Cold Stone Creamery. Looks like a bass viol, a guitar, and could be a mandolin strumming away. Sunny day down here at about 125. Listening to it, of course, is Charlie Phillips, producer of a number of community TV shows in the old days. And there's an open guitar case here with, looks like they've been picking a few dollar bills. Hey, Charlie, want to say something for Free Radio?
Free Radio is a heart and soul Santa Cruz.
Hey, thank you. Anything else?
Just listen to John Malcolm and yours truly speaking now to me, and also the guy that does the show on Friday evening. What's his name? You know. Anyway, Free Radio is the way to go.
Thank you. And Charlie's an old-time activist. I've often been on, occasionally been on separate sides from Charlie, but he's been a hard worker at community TV. He's now significantly disabled. I believe he has Parkinson's. He was in a wheelchair. A little hard to understand exactly what he was saying, but it's good to see people out there, good to hear their voices, even if you can't always understand everything that's said. Quite sure how much of that was intelligible, but that was Charlie Phillips. And here are some strummers and pickers in front of O'Neill's, the Committee to Defeat George Bush, Santa Cruz. Illegally playing, of course, with a display device less than 10 feet from a building. Shame on them. It's another bass viol, another guitar, and another mandolin. Or is this the same group, and am I seeing things? Who knows? And it looks like the advance contingent of the Safe Singers with the ever-present, Valerie and Brian from Days of Yore with his fancy-looking guitar. What's happening, Brian?
How you doing?
Good.
Well, today's my birthday, and God bless you.
And you have Jesus in me loves you, but do you in me love me? What's the answer?
Well,
how well do you know me, and when do we have a date?
Well, I don't know you really that well, but
a candid man, not man prone to.
Well, I'll be honest with you. I know what you're saying. Yeah, me personally, yeah, I really do. I really would I'm not hiding behind a Christian belief. I really do love people, and
you seem to be enjoying being out on the streets here.
Yeah, enjoying the outdoors today, and there's a couple of snappers out here earlier, but other than that, it's been pretty well.
Yeah, well, the sunshine, of course, is beautiful. It's not hot yet. The wind is pleasant. And what do you think, Valerie? You're here safing it up?
Well, we were going to do it right here, but it looks like there's a group right here playing, so we may just be up the street by the flowers. I'm not sure. I'm waiting for Michael to catch up. He was trying to pick up.
Merryweather Mike?
Yeah, bring musicians up as we go. And besides, where's my hug?
Now you have one more. You can give me some music. I don't want no paper at this time. Thank you. I'll take a hug.
Oh, hug.
Getting a hug from the notorious Valerie, the hug master of the downtown.
This is the best hug person. Come and hug Robert Norris.
All right. A hug from Brian.
God bless you.
Ryan is a man who can really take you in his arms. Got
to
say that.
Well, you know, I just have to say that the Lord's arms are much bigger than mine.
Have it, if you believe in such things.
We feel because of the gay pride parade that was happening today, there's a lot of good, cheerful energy, and so we're thinking we're going to have a lot of good support from the people around us today.
I don't agree with it, but I have to say that earlier this woman snapped at me because of my American flag on my back. She had some nasty words to say. And after I complimented her and told her how beautiful she was, she still turned around and completely disrespected me.
Well, what was her sexual preference? Maybe she felt you were coming on to her.
No. She was, she looked like some kind of a, she was a woman with another woman. She was a dyke.
Or a supporter of people of different sexual preferences.
Well, yeah, but I had no problem with it. The bottom line
same sex preference.
The bottom line is, I was full of compliments. And I was sharing the word of the Lord, telling her how much Jesus Christ.
Well, some people regard American flags as sort of an endorsement of Bush's foreign policy.
Well, you know, the bottom line is that we live in America, and we could be in a much worse place. So I feel really privileged and lucky that I live in such a nation.
Well, I'm sure that some people in the Roman Empire in Rome felt the same way, but Rome was nonetheless looting, plundering, and raping all the rest of the world in order to support the folks at home.
Sure, I understand that. But on the other hand, you've got to think, every nation has its problems. We all have issues. But the bottom line is we're still a blessed nation. We still have lots of things.
Is plunder, rape, and rapine a blessing or a curse? That, of course, is a question which only you can answer.
Well, see, the thing is ultimately I don't have all the answers, but I can say that things of that are wrong. But I can't say this.
That's the reason I think she was angry with you, because the flag on your back to her symbolized support for those things, when in fact you're saying you don't support those things.
Well, see, the bottom line is that I don't support sin, right. But I do support my country because I love this country. I've lived here all my life, and it's been good to me.
Are imperialists sinners?
Even so, the nation is the way it is. Even so, the nation's going to pots. Everything is just falling apart. Even so, Bush has made some bad decisions.
Like what?
The war and all that stuff. That's just wrong. But see, the bottom line is that, you know, we still have to stand. It's just like, you know, when you're in a love relationship with a man and a woman. If they do wrong, you still have
to... Or a man and a man, or a woman and a woman?
Well, I don't agree with that. You know, I just don't agree with that. To me, that's wrong. The Lord was not confused when he made Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. It's very clear. If you can't see that, then there's a problem. There's definitely some definite mental issues going on there, and only the Lord can heal that. But you have to be open-hearted to receive the message.
Well, we have gotten your message, at least in part, Brian.
Right.
Thank you, and good luck with the music today.
Well, God bless you, and I just wanted to say Jesus loves us all, and just keep an open heart to the Lord. You know, he really loves us, and he's so good to us.
Thank you. It's June 6, 2005, about 8:30 up here in front of Cody's Books in Berkeley, talking with
B.N. Duncan.
And B.N. Duncan is here at his bookstand with numerous books by Claire Birch, the famous Berkeley author, including What Really Killed Rosebud.
And Claire Birch is also a terrific video documenter. Of course, I'm biased because she did a video about me and a magazine I used to do on the Avenue called Telly Times.
I think may have purchased that same documentary from you on my last visit up here.
I think this is quite possible. And
I've actually looked at it. I must say, this is the only place probably in history, at the current time in history, you'll be able to see every issue of the Telegraph Times, which have since even disappeared from your files.
I do have at least one copy of every issue. That is to say, there's certain early issues where I know I have at least one copy of an issue.
So it is true that archive does survive.
And there are some issues where I made this, where I still have enough left where I could actually sell a few. As a matter of fact, maybe this could be something of interest. On June 21st at Book Zoo, which I really recommend when you get a chance, you keep your eye on. Take a look.
The address of Book Zoo is?
Book Zoo. They're in the same complex of restaurants and businesses as Fondue Fred's, which is... you know, you keep walking south along Telegraph on the west side, you cross Dwight, then you cross Blake. A bit south of Blake in the direction of Oakland on the west side of Telegraph is this place that looks kind of like a garage that's been converted. It has a lot of restaurants in it, some other businesses, including a very small bookstore called Booksu. It's run by two really good guys, Nick and Eric, who are bright, original people with an original slant. They really want to make the bookstore not just a place to sell things, but a place that's kind of a creative and educational center.
And it's actually very badly needed.
We need some kind of alternative to the usual kind of thing around here.
It's in a courtyard where you can actually buy coffee, sit down, or...
I don't think it's news to any of us here that some things that were doing pretty well, flourishing, you know, some kinds of creative things have kind of dried up around here. And we really need something like Booksu. I think it would be great if we had five or six places kind of like Booksu, you know.
Well, you also are circulating petitions here. Bring back the real quarter meal. What was the previous quarter meal, and why is it no longer the real?
For many years, the quarter meal always served complete meals 5 days a week.
What is the quarter meal, for those who don't know?
Well, the quarter meal is a meal where you pay 25 cents for a meal. You know, it's for poor people, needy people, or actually anybody really could go, theoretically. But
What does it usually consist of?
Actually, they will sometimes let people in if they don't have anything, you know.
What did it consist of?
What you would do is, like, 5 days a week you could go there, pay your quarter, or sometimes get in for free anyway, even if you didn't have a quarter. You'd sit down with a tray of food that had a balanced meal. You'd have a main dish. They might have some meat or some kind of special veggie thing, because there was always a choice between a meat version of the main dish or a veggie dinner.
How old is this meal? I mean, how long is
a salad? You'd have a salad. You'd have cooked vegetables, warm cooked vegetables. The main dish, cooked warm vegetables, a salad. You'd have something else. You'd have something for dessert. You know, you kind of a complete kind of array for a meal.
When did it start, this meal?
Actually, I went to Gus Schultz at the old location for the quarter meal up at University of Lutheran Chapel. For many years, he had a lot to do with the quarter meal going on at that University of Lutheran Chapel.
It was going on in 1970 when I was in Berkeley.
And he looked it up, and as far as he could tell from the records, the first meal of the Berkeley Emergency Food and Housing Project was served sometime in February 1970.
Huh.
I was a little disappointed because I thought it was one of those things that started in Berkeley in 69. Certain things did start in 69 for the first time. I had assumed that, but there's kind of a thing going on. You know, it was always the Berkeley Emergency Food and Housing Project. Well, first it was the Berkeley Emergency Food Project, then it became the Berkeley Emergency Food and Housing Project. But now they've taken the word emergency out of the title. Now it's just the Berkeley Food and Housing Project. They don't seem to want to treat the need for food and shelter as an emergency anymore.
Well, heck, who cares? Know what I mean?
Well, actually, you know, somebody who's a real hip guy from way back, a guy I know, tells me that lots of people, there's been massive protest over the curtailing of the meals at the quarter meal, but they just go their merry way. They don't care. It's like they don't, evidently the people who run the quarter meal can get away with this, so they keep getting away with it. But to continue, I didn't finish. Anyway, so for 5 days a week, they had a complete meal. But what's been happening is only 3 days a week do they have that. And for Thursdays and Fridays, they have these kind of skimpy bag lunches. Instead of 5 days a week complete meals, they have complete meals Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Then for Thursday and Friday, they have these kind of skimpy bag lunches that they just hand to you and you take away. And some people feel that they would really like to get the service back they used to have.
Are they claiming this is because of cutbacks? And how are they funded?
Well, I haven't really asked. I haven't asked anybody in charge. I don't know what it is. Maybe they would say that. Maybe somebody would say that. I'm not sure what's going on.
You are circulating a petition, which is, I am signing this petition you're asking people to sign because I feel the Berkeley Food Project should stop serving takeout lunches on Thursday and Friday. If they can't serve the same kind of meal they serve on the first 3 days of the week, they should allow the People's Park meal to continue. Does the Berkeley Food Project have any control over the People's Park meal, and what is the People's Park meal?
Well, now, for quite some time, what was going on was the quarter meal was only having a meal 3 days a week. Then the remaining 2 days of the 5-day week, Thursday and Friday, the Catholic Workers stepped in with J.C. Orton in People's Park and would give a meal. And actually, they would often give a lot of food. They often give a lot of really good food. They give a real variety of food. A lot of our meals are really wonderful. But there's some kind of something happened where the Cardinal said, okay, we won't just not have any meals for people on Thursday and Friday. We'll do a bag lunch. We'll give them a takeaway bag lunch. So it seems that the Catholic Worker, J.C. Orton, they aren't doing the meals in People's Park anymore because the Corps Meal is doing the bag lunches on those days.
Have you talked to J.C. to see what his position is on?
I'm sorry to say I haven't talked to him or asked him about it. I'm sorry I can't tell you.
And that's an interview with Duncan, who is, as you've heard, the editor of the Telly Times, publication from many years ago, and also an ongoing artist, activist, cartoonist, cop watcher. He's got a variety of hats. You can often find him in front of Cody's Bookstore, for those of you who know Berkeley, about 4 blocks from the UCSC campus on the south side at Haste and Telegraph. And what we were discussing there, perhaps at too great a length, was his petitioning to restore the a meal in the park, a block away at People's Park, a famous park that was occupied by the community to stop the University of California from tearing it down and building student apartments, and then to stop the city from building a parking lot there, and then to stop the city and the university from building sports courts there in the early 90s. There's a whole history behind keeping it a community space. And the response of the university and the city and the police has been to harass the park quite regularly, folks in the park, where it's used kind of as a refuge, like our Santa Cruz city parks. It's illegal to sleep there at night. Actually, unlike our city parks, I think you can go through there, but Santa Cruz City Park, as most folks probably know, close at dusk because, as we know, all good people have homes and can go back to their homes at night, and the rest of them should just get lost and not use the parks at night. In fact, the rest of the community should avoid using them so as not to encourage the terrorist menace, the drug menace, the youth menace, you name it, the menace. So, interesting interview. Parts of it are interesting. It's a little bit, goes on too great a length. I'm going to try to be a little bit more selective, and I'm going to play more of it in a bit. And I'm also actually waiting to hear a phone call from Scott Graham, local activist. I call him Scope It Out Scott because he has a rather interesting opinionated perspective on Santa Cruz in terms of the internal workings at City Council in terms of present issues. He's very outspoken in what he says. He also, I think, puts issues very clearly and coherently. You might not always agree with him, but he's got a point of view, I think, which is worth listening and considering. We'll be hearing from him shortly on the Ron Lau property issue, which I've brought up on the show a couple of times. Ron Lau is the owner of the vacant property next to Lulu Carpenter's, partially vacant. Some of it's occupied by a few restaurants in the back there. Most of it is vacant, which the city, I guess, has now moved to condemn and to eminent domain, force him to sell to them for their own project. And we're going to talk to Scott about that. And actually, I have another interview with Scott, which I may also play, particularly if he doesn't call in fairly soon. I think he's having dinner right now, so we'll hope he can get in touch at some point. Wow. Phone number here, in case you want to call in here yourself and chat, is 427-3772. And I'm hoping to get a call in from the Compassion Flower Inn's Andrea Tischler, who has, I think, a copy of a letter from Valerie Corral of Wham, co-founder of Wham, that did a dynamite demonstration at the town clock a couple of days ago in the wake of the infamous Raich versus Ashcroft Supreme Court decision, which makes every kind of possession of marijuana, however medical, a form of crime under federal law. Even though it doesn't throw out the state laws, it in essence says the feds can do whatever the hell they want without any kind of restrictions. You can't use the necessity defense, et cetera, et cetera. Looks like we got a caller. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hello, Robert.
Yes.
Hello.
Hi, are you there? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Sounds like Scott to me. How you doing, Scott?
All right.
So you actually gave me quite a rundown on the city council meeting on Tuesday when we were there, the special city council meeting, which was there primarily to do the city council's done deal agenda of condemning Ron Lau's property. But because I don't have it queued up at the moment, maybe you could kind of revisit that issue and kind of discuss for us what you came into the meeting looking to talk about, what you found there.
Well, basically, I was going to the meeting to support Ron and his bid to develop the property himself or with his group of people he put together. And basically, I thought the other group of people that the city had brought together to develop the property, that there was something kind of fishy with what was going on there. I mean, first of all, they claimed that the developer approached the city or approached the redevelopment agency about doing a development there. No, it seemed to me that any reasonable person that wanted to develop a piece of property would go and speak to the person that owned that property, not go to the city and say, hey, listen, if you can steal this property away from this guy, I'll build a really nice building there.
Can you tell us a little bit before we go any further so we can kind of set this in context, a little bit about Ron Lau, who he is, why people should be sympathetic to him if they should be, what this is all about? I mean, he's talked on the air before. We've heard he's an environmentalist and he's concerned about green building. But he has had this piece of property vacant for 17 years, right, or 16 years.
14.
14?
Yeah.
Well, since 1989, so that's
right.
16, sounds like. But, quite a while. What elicits your sympathy for Ron? And tell us, I guess he was the landlord for the old bookshop Santa Cruz and the Café Pergolesi and the Café Zeno.
Right. Well, one of the things is that prior to the earthquake, the city was coming up with rules on whether or not some of the old unreinforced brick structures downtown should be forced by city code to be reinforced. Well, Ron wanted to do that to his building, but his tenant, Neil Coonerty, led the charge downtown with the Downtown Business Association to get the city to back off and not force all the building owners to retrofit their building.
You're talking about Neil Coonerty, former mayor of Santa Cruz.
You're right, kind of his son is now sitting on the council.
The man behind the downtown ordinances that make it illegal to sit down and so forth, but also the owner of the somewhat liberal bookshop Santa Cruz, which lets people use their bathrooms in a sort of a public way, provided you're not Robert Norris or some other excluded person.
I guess. I've never used their bathroom, so I don't know how open their bathrooms are to the public.
They used to allow people, Neil Coonerty used to allow people to sleep in front of, a person or two to sleep in front of his bookstore without a complaint. And there's a liberal aspect to him that I do want to give him credit for, even though I feel, he has in the main been a reactionary force. And you're saying that he stood against retrofitting the buildings against the earthquake, which I think ultimately resulted in the death of two people in the coffee roasting company right next door to his bookstore.
Right. Yeah. And Neil was one of many. He actually led the charge, got a bunch of the other business owners to put pressure on the city to say, listen, we don't need to, it'll disrupt our business, because that's what he's afraid of. If Ron Lau had reinforced that building, the bookshop would have been closed for several months while that was going on. And Neil didn't want his business to close, and all these other businesses downtown where people, were renting the building space and that, they didn't own the building, they didn't want their landlords retrofitting their buildings either. Nobody wanted to be forced to close their business for anywhere from 3 to 7 months to make the buildings safe in the event of an earthquake.
In retrospect, it was a bad decision. Have those buildings been reinforced, or are the current buildings reinforced against the earthquake now? Or?
Well, the current buildings are built to a different standard than the old ones were. Whether or not the standard they're built to will withstand a quake is debatable. I mean, I know a number of people in the construction trades that say that they think that what they did in these new buildings really won't withstand an earthquake, that they'll actually, instead of, you know, just pieces of the building falling down, the entire building will just tip over as one big building, which might cause even more devastation than just having pieces and parts of the building fall off.
Well, so Ron had some ideas that I think probably we both agree with on retrofitting the building, but for the next 16 years, he let essentially most of his property remain vacant, though there are three or four small businesses on the back side of it. And finally, the redevelopment agency got impatient and has moved to, take it away from him. But why should we be? Tell us more about why we should be sympathetic with Ron.
Well, part of it is that, you know, this massive hotel project that they wanted to build out there where the Dream Inn is. They kept on touting that as being a green. They were the hotel owners agreed to build a green building there and da 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 da. Well, Bolton Hill, the developer that the city found to develop this property, has never said a word about green building until the other night when Ron's people got up and talked about how this was going to be a green building and stuff.
What is a green building?
Well, it's using newer construction techniques where you're not using a bunch of, you know, because a lot of newer buildings are built with, synthetic materials, which often leads to what they call sick building syndrome, where people that work in those buildings get sick from just being inside the building because there's so many weird gases coming off of these synthetic materials and, you know, man-made materials that the building's built out of. So a green building is built to a different standard where you're using things that, you know, materials that don't gas off, toxic chemicals. Other things that they do is they use bigger windows to allow more light into the building, so you're not using as much electricity to light the interior of the building. You're also letting the light in, which will heat the building in the wintertime because there's more light coming into the building. Things like reclaiming rainwater and using that to flush toilets and whatnot. There's a whole series of different steps that can be taken to make a green building.
Is this Ron built or, you know, arranged for the building of any other buildings, or would this be his first project?
Well, this is basically, with the agreement that Ron made with his developers, it's now out of his hands. I mean, he leased them the building for 99, he leased them the site for 99 years. With a stipulation that they build a green building.
And this was done fairly recently, like on the very afternoon of the city council meeting last Tuesday.
You know, that was the reason the city council gave for not believing that Ron was serious about all this, is because the paperwork wasn't all there for them to look at. And so they didn't know whether to believe these people or not to believe them, and so they chose not to believe them.
And I know that you and I, we had a lunch with Ron and talked to him about this, and he claimed his application for a plan had been already put through the planning department, or at least introduced to the planning department, whereas Shanna McCord, Sentinel writer, and I guess Marty Ackerman, the redevelopment agency assistant czarina, who's sort of in charge of this project, claimed that this was sort of a not particularly meaningful application, or am I misquoting her?
Well, Marty Ackerman had a whole bunch of things in her presentation that weren't quite accurate. I mean, she claim that Ron only came forward with one proposal back in 92 or something and had never come forward with another proposal. Well, in the last 4 years, I've seen him come forward with three other proposals besides the one he brought in the other night. And the first proposal that I saw him bring in about 4 or 5 years ago, he wanted to build a hotel in that spot. You have the bottom floor be retail, and then the top 4 floors be a downtown hotel. Now, a city that's strapped for cash like Santa Cruz, a hotel would be a great deal because they get the city gets to keep all of the taxes from the hotel tax, unlike sales tax where the city only gets about a penny of your sales tax. And, you know, property tax, right now, the property tax isn't coming back to the city at all. Arnold is keeping all the property tax to balance the state budget.
Mm-hmm. So, what, about 9 or 10% tax per every dollar spent?
I think it's 10% right now is the hotel tax.
Plus, of course, the loss of the St. George Hotel as a real hotel. We don't really have a real hotel. We have some
right, there is no hotel downtown anymore. I mean, at one time, the Palomar was a real hotel, too. Mm-hmm. And...
But this wasn't the proposal that Ron brought before the city on Tuesday, right?
No, Tuesday's proposal was for a 5-story building with a first floor retail and restaurants, second floor offices, and the top 3 floors apartments, rental apartments.
So nothing...
Unlike the city's preferred developer, Bolton Hill, which wants to do the bottom floor retail and then the top 4 floors, for sale condominiums, which are going to cost close to $1 million apiece.
Well, we're only going to get only the best people from San Jose and Tahoe, perhaps.
Well, one thing is, I don't know if the guy's going to be able to sell them. Secondly, I think it's a real bad use for that space.
Well... It's also, I mean, we're not really talking about, and I've actually asked Ron this question several times on the air. I mean, why should low-income people give a shit one way or the other, whether it's, you know, the rich or the super rich that get into these buildings? I mean, it's certainly not going to be poor people, right?
Well, see, if it was rental units, 15% of them would have to be for low-income people. But since they're for sale units, that doesn't apply. I mean, Bolton Hill doesn't have to build the low-income units on that site. They don't actually have to build them anywhere. They can just pay this in lieu fee, and not in which is costs less money than actually building a low-income unit would cost.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is that the tax increment, which is what redevelopment lives on. And that's the difference between what the property was taxed at before the earthquake and what the property is taxed at on its value after the new building is built. Now, that difference in those two tax rates, the redevelopment agency keeps all of that tax.
Now, the redevelopment agency is a group that you have criticized on a number of occasions as engaging in boondoggle projects like the Nueva Vista Dolphin Lee project, supporting the Coast Santa Cruz Hotel project, and also just having no significant oversight, although the city council members claim that they sit as the redevelopment agency board, and so they are providing masterful oversight to the redevelopment agency.
Well, Robert, I mean, since you've been paying attention to this process, when has the city council had any significant questions for the redevelopment staff when they've come to passing whatever, you know, it's basically, oh yeah, let's pass what the staff's recommendation is, you know. There is no oversight.
Well, that's because of the fine leadership from Cecil Cirillo.
Right, everything's perfect by the time it gets to the council, right?
Well, they work out the little kinks and the details in the back room, you know.
But anyway, you get back to the tax increment. 20% of that money that the redevelopment agency brings in the form of the tax increment, by state law, has to be set aside for low-income housing projects. So that's like the only good thing that they do, although, as you mentioned, the last time they built a low-income housing project, very few of the low-income people they said were going to be the people in that project actually came back once they were evicted from the properties where they were living, the Dolphin and the Lee. Once the project got started, most of those people didn't make it back into the new buildings. And that was the whole justification for doing that project in the first place, was to give those people that lived at those two sites a better place to live.
And of course,
if you bring back less than 10% of those people, I mean, first of all, they didn't even build enough units for all of them to come back in the first place. So they weren't even planning on actually housing all the people that lived there. But then, as it came down, it's, I think, under 10% of the original occupants of those two properties now reside at the new project.
Have you seen figures to that effect? Because I'm not clear that that's an accurate figure.
Well, I mean, what figures do you have? I mean, what percentage of the original occupants?
It's muddy. What the claim by the city is, and by the redevelopment agency, and by people like Tim Fitzmaurice, is that everybody who lived there previously either got, as you know, first option, or whatever the hell it was, that
First right of refusal,
whatever, to come back, or they got funding if they wanted to move somewhere else. I think $5,200 to move on, and in some cases $40,000 to build or buy a home. That was a smaller group, and I wasn't really able to either. Maybe it was I didn't properly or clearly understand or interpret the ultimate figures that came out of that. I know that the Western Service Workers Association people have not received a lot of complaints from the people currently living in the Nueva Vista, that is the Dolphin Lee project the redevelopment agency used 17 years of housing money on. And so maybe that means they're all happy. Maybe it means they're scared to say anything. Maybe it means that they may be happy, but as you say, a lot of people have left. But getting back to Ron Lau, Ron had a proposal. You said it was significantly better because it involved green building, because it involved apartments and not condominiums. What other things do you think made Ron a better bet than Bolton Hill, or the, I guess Jeff Dunn was involved with this whole project?
Well, Jeff Dunn is he's one of the biggest two-faced bastards going. But
clarify
you
that.
You can quote me on that one.
Clarify that, please.
Well, I mean, Jeff has been on the wrong side of every development issue ever to face the city. I mean, he was all in favor of the Coastal Hotel deal. He was all in favor of the Beach South of Laurel plan. You know, any development scheme that comes by, Jeff's in favor of it. I mean, he's always touting himself, I'm a seventh-generation Santa Cruzian. Well, fuck, dude, why do you want to destroy the town your family's been here for in seven generations for? You think that, you know, you might have the sense to want to slow down the development and do it in a sensible way instead of just, you know, like latching on to every friggin' development project that comes down the pipe.
So,
I mean, he's got his head so far up Barry Swinson's ass that if Barry was to take a quick left turn, he'd snap Jeff's neck.
We should have Jeff on to examine that particular statistic and see if he thinks it's accurate. But since he's not here, and I can't really speak for him, but I'll pass on your perspective to him next time I see him.
Okay.
But again, I was there for part of this debate at the city council on Tuesday when the issue was, should the city council take this whole project out of Ron Lau's hands and turn it over to I guess Jeff Dunn produced this developer or kind of worked up this deal with Bolton Hill, or I'm not quite sure what his role was. But
I would say Jeff is the backroom deal maker. You know, he's the one that probably went in, talked to Cecil Cirillo and said, you know, let's do something about Lau's property. He's just a no good drunken Hawaiian. Let's get rid of him, you know, and find somebody that will actually do something with his property.
And so the Bolton Hill people were there with their plans, and then Ron Lau had some people who seemed to have some rather specific plans, which they presented. But again, I guess you say they lacked the documents to prove that there was this 99-year agreement?
Right. Yeah, no one produced that, and I think that was the linchpin of, you know, the city council even being willing to give Ron another, you know, 30 days, 60 days, or 90 days, or any amount of time to do anything. Now, some of the city council members have said, you know, during their comments was that, well, you know, there is still time for Ron to strike a deal with Bolton Hill. Well, I don't know if he can anymore. I mean, he's already leased the land to these other developers. So if that's the case, then, you know, the city's not going to be fighting Ron Lau now when it comes time to actually try to steal this land. They're not going to be stealing it from Ron. They're going to be stealing it from these other developers.
Now, what's the timetable here? I mean, that the eminent domain resolution passed, right?
Right.
And it passed by what vote?
Unanimous.
That included that great liberal Ed Porter?
Yeah, everybody, I mean, Ed was, you know, hemming and hawing and shuffling. I mean, the entire council, plus Murray Ackerman, they all seemed to be quite ashamed of themselves for what they were about to do. I mean, Marty Ackerman, during her little presentation, could hardly get the words out half the time because she knew that everything she was saying was a friggin' lie.
Give us an example.
Well, like what I said about her saying that Ron had only brought one project forward in 14 and a half years. That was bullshit, and she knew it, you know. And then when she was going through the list of findings the city had to make in order to take his property, because there was like four different things that they had to conclude were the conditions before they could legally take his property. And when she was going through that list, she kept on choking up, because as she was reading off, you know, what the conditions was and then why they could make that finding, she knew that what she was saying wasn't accurate.
Yeah, I'm looking at the conditions: that public interest and necessity require condemnation of the property interest, that the project is planned or located in the manner that will be most compatible with the greatest public good and the least private injury, that the offer to the owners has been made to buy the property, and that the property sought is necessary for the project, and the proposed purchase includes no more than is necessary for the project. I guess, you know, I don't know if it's fruitful to go into it in greater detail here, because this is a show concerned with the rights of poor people who don't really have much to do with this property, although you pointed out a small segment of them might get into the low income, which is not very low income, so that wouldn't include Section 8 necessarily.
Well, it could. I mean, I know, at Owl Towers, the 15% of those units that are low income, they accept the Section 8 certificates. But, you know, because those are all studios, it's, you know, only single people that get Section 8 or can get in there.
Uh-huh.
Like, you know, the three-bedroom apartments in Owl Towers don't take the Section 8 vouchers.
Right. And, I mean, but my concern, and perhaps those and yours too, has also been that the public process here is really not a public process. That what goes on is a previously worked up deal, usually not even by the city council, but by the staff, is being essentially prefabricated and then fed into the city council machine, which punches it out like ticker tape, right?
Right. Well, it's like, it's, I mean, that's the problem that I've said all along with redevelopment, is that these projects come forward with little or no public input, and then get presented to the city council as a done deal. And the city council is, you know, sitting as the redevelopment agency, either gives them the thumbs up or the thumbs down. And I have never seen them turn the redevelopment agency down on a project yet.
As a devil's advocate, however, you have at certain points wondered if Ron wasn't simply trying to inflate the value of his property, right? I mean,
that's one of the point. You know, like one of the things you just read in those four conditions that they offered to buy the property from. Well, they offered him $1.5 million. When the city bought the Dolphin and the Lee properties, they paid $1.5 million for one of them and $1.2 million for the other. Neither of those properties are as large as Ron's property, and neither of those properties are zoned commercial, which Ron's is. Ron's is right on the main commercial street in downtown. It's like, it's got to be worth at least three times what they offered him for. They offered him $1.5 million for it. It's probably worth somewhere between $4 and $5 million.
Did that come up at city council?
Ed Davison brought it up.
Uh-huh.
In his comments.
So a couple members of the public, but no council member, Dane?
No. When the guy that owns Bolton Hill, I forgot what his name is, when he came up and spoke, he decided that he would speak after all the public comments so that he could, like, poo-poo anything the public has to say about him. When he went up to smoke, after he got done speaking, Tim Fitzmaurice asked him, well, what kind of process did you go through to try to negotiate with Ron Lowell? What was the outcome of all that? Well, the guy was totally vague. He said, well, I met with Ron and his lawyers once, and I thought we had an agreement, and then when we sent Ron the paperwork that we had agreed upon, he wouldn't sign it. Well, I talked to Ron during the break. They took a break right after the public comment, and he said that they had an agreement, in essence, with a guy when he was talking to his lawyers. Then he left, went and had his lawyers draw up these papers and sent them to Ron's lawyers. None of the stuff that they had agreed to were in those papers.
Such
so
as
Ron refused to sign it.
So, in other words, the sort of a shifty deal where there wasn't really a proper agreement; it was a simulated agreement.
Right. Uh-huh. And you know,
did Ron bring this up to the city council? I
mean, Ron didn't go up and speak at all.
And why do you think that was?
Because he knows the city council doesn't like him. He knows the city manager Dick Wilson doesn't like him. He knows Steele Cirillo doesn't like him. So he figured that was the reason why he signed this 99-year lease with his developers, was so that the city would know that they're not dealing with Ron anymore, that they're dealing with this other group of people.
Apparently they don't care.
They don't have to deal with Ron directly at all anymore.
But they apparently don't seem to care in terms of proceeding at their, you know, train wreck pace.
See, the whole thing is, Robert, is that hopefully these people that Ron assembled to be the developers of his site will just continue on and, you know, keep the planning process for their project going. Excuse me. And because the city, just because they made this vote the other night, that doesn't mean that they've automatically started, you know, that just means they voted to start the process of condemnation. That the condemnation didn't happen the other night.
So what's the next step?
Well, the next step is they have to get a judge to sign off on this. They have to draw up all the papers, and, you know, it's a legal process they have to go through. And they have to get one of the judges here in the county to sign off on this, that their reasons for doing this are valid.
And you don't think that's going to happen, or?
Well, it depends on how it's done. I mean, if it's done in a way where Ron's developers get their lawyers are allowed into that hearing and can present their side of things, I don't think it'll happen. But even if it's done in some sort of closed hearing where it's just the city attorney or the city's hotshot redevelopment lawyer from Sacramento, T. Brent Hawkins, if it's done in some sort of closed hearing like that, then Ron's developer can still say, listen, you know, we're not budging. We still have this property. We're not selling it to you. We're not, you know, you can't have it. And they can file an appeal to that whole process.
Why should people in Santa Cruz be concerned about this issue? I mean, we spent about half an hour talking about it. Why? Some people are probably falling asleep, nodding off, wandering off to the movies.
Well, I mean, one of the things is it just shows you how arrogant the city council is. And, you know, people should start paying attention to this crap. And, you know, the next time there's a city council election, don't just elect somebody because they're a friggin' lecturer up at UCSC and have a diarrhea of the mouth, or don't just elect somebody because they work at Planned Parenthood.
You're talking about
or
Cynthia.
They work for the Resource Center for Nonviolence. You know, find out what these people are really like when they're sitting up there. You know, most of them are arrogant friggin' bastards that don't give a shit about what the public thinks.
Well, I noticed that this particular Tuesday City Council meeting was not televised.
Right, because they were, I think that it wasn't televised because they were ashamed of what they were about to do. Hmm. And they didn't want the scrutiny of, you know, armchair politicians sitting at home being able to see this.
We've been talking with Scott Graham, who's a longtime council watcher. Anything coming up at the next council meeting you want to make us aware of?
I haven't seen the agenda for next week yet, so I'm not really sure what's on it.
I think it just came out.
But there
this
is
evening.
A meeting tonight at the Civic Center, in the ABC room of the Civic Center, uh-huh, about the La Bahia. And what's going on there is that two or three years ago, Barry Swenson, on behalf of the Seaside Company, got permits to rebuild rebuild the front part of the La Bahia, and then once that was finished, then build additional units out back. Well, they've had this building permit for about 3 years now and haven't done a thing. Now they're coming back and saying, oh, rebuilding the front is not feasible, it's not economically feasible, we can't do it, we just want to rip it down. So we'll just have one big project instead of doing it in two phases where we restore the front and then build the new part in the back. We'll just tear down the front part and build one brand new place all at once.
And what's wrong with that?
Well, I mean, first of all, one of the reasons the city agreed to all this in the first place was because they were going to restore the front part of it. Now that's no longer on the table. They want that taken off the table. They don't want to restore the front part of it. Secondly, the other thing that enticed the city to do this was that they were going to use union labor to build it and union labor to run the hotel. Well, the only problem with that, I mentioned right at the very beginning, was that Barry Swenson has a really bad track record of using union labor on any of his jobs, and Canfield has a very bad track record of using union labor at any of his places.
Canfield, of course, is the owner of the Seaside Company and the board.
Right, which is, you know, has had the police arrest union organizers that tried to organize the labor at the boardwalk on several occasions.
So tonight at the ABC room of the Civic Auditorium, I guess starting 15 minutes ago, This is a discussion of the... Is this one of these meaningful discussions where the public has some real input, or is this a situation where the city council has got some fast-track program that they're pushing through again?
Well, the other day, if you can believe the Sentinel, Rockin was quoted in the Sentinel as saying, well, I don't care what the neighbors think. If they don't like a five-story hotel sitting in front of them, well, they can move. They don't have to live behind this five-story hotel. Because the... What was approved before was a three-story hotel. Now Barry Swenson and Canfield want to build a five-story hotel there and not do the restoration of the front. They just want to tear the front down. So it's just, you know, it's just a matter of...
Now, organizing from different neighborhood groups dissuaded the Northwest Hospitality Group from proceeding with the Coast Santa Cruz Hotel after the folks organizing against it got enough signatures to put the matter on the ballot as an initiative. Is the same group, SCRAP, still organizing? Is that what it's called? SCRAP, Santa Cruzans for Responsible Progress or whatever?
Santa Cruzians for Responsible Planning.
Aha, gotcha.
I think a number of them will probably be at this meeting tonight to see what Barry and Canfield are putting forward, but, you know...
So you don't have any sense necessarily, though, that this is a done deal?
Well, I think if this plan was to go in front of the city, you know, after what Rockin said in the paper the other day about it, if this was to go in front of the city council, they would get a majority to approve it. And get number than a club, Tony Madrigal. Oh, union. Even though both of these people involved, Canfield and Swenson, have never honored a union agreement ever, Tony would go for it once he heard the word union. And, you know, Neil Coonerty is like, you know, being spoon-fed pablum by the developer. So
you're talking about Neil Coonerty or Ryan Coonerty?
Ryan Coonerty, sorry. So he's going to go for it. So right. Then you got, you know, all you need is Rockin and Matthews. And Rockin already said he's in favor of it. I don't see how Matthews is going to be against it.
Why should poor people be concerned about this issue, whether it's three stories or five stories, whether the front is reconstructed or not, whether the neighbors like it or not? You know, how does that impact, you know, people who are poor and hungry?
Well, one of the ways that it could have impacted them, which was a couple of years ago, they tried to get a hotel tax that would have paid for the Homeless Resource Center and other homeless needs, which didn't pass. And then a year or so later, they tried to get another hotel tax that would only provide corporate welfare for the Visitors Council. And that didn't pass either. But, you know, possibly at some point in the future, we could get another hotel tax, maybe just one penny out of every, 1%. For homeless services. And, you know, the only problem with doing something like that, you know, I'll have to put this caveat in there, is once you have a dedicated tax to something like this, like homeless services, then the city can say, oh, good, we no longer have to give them any money out of the general fund. So even if that tax didn't cover what they're currently doing there, the city would probably be reluctant to fund them any further, you know.
Santa Cruz Sentinel has headlined Dick Wilson's special tax initiative for the utility tax coming up, I guess, in August. Any comments on that?
Well, I've always been against this particular tax they're talking about. This isn't the utility tax that's on your phone bill or your electric bill. This is the utility tax that's on your water and garbage and sewer bill. And to me, that's double dipping. You know, because first of all, they're asking you to pay for your water, your sewer, and your garbage collection. And then once they do this for you, they tax you on it. Now, they were calling this tax a fee. That's why it never got put in front of the voters for the voters to vote on it, because they called it a fee. Well, legally, the only way it could be a fee is if that money went back into the sewer, water, and garbage units of the city. But instead, the city was collecting the so-called fee and putting dumping it into the general fund. Since they were doing that, it's no longer, you can't consider it a fee then. It's considered a tax.
Yet,
like I said, to me, that's double dipping. If you're charging some, you know, it's different than going to McDonald's and having to pay tax on your cheeseburger. This is a city service. The city is delivering water to your house through the pipes. Then they charge you tax on top of that. That's double dipping, you know. There's no other way around it.
Which, in essence, is what they've been doing for a couple of decades, and now that they don't have that money, they're claiming they're going to have to severely cut back on services and other stuff.
Well, some tax crusaders took them to court over it.
Right. What's your suggestion to deal with the city deficit if this tax is not passed?
Fire all the department heads.
Wait a minute. You mean Police Chief Scary would be fired?
Yeah, every single one of them. Anybody that's making over $100,000 a year, get rid of them.
Well, we're talking with that radical firebrand, Scott Graham. Scott, thank you for your suggestions. A member of Homeland Security will be visiting you shortly.
All right.
And keep us advised if you're going to this La Bahia meeting tonight.
Yeah, I was going to probably head down there in a little bit.
Maybe you can give us a report on what's cooking.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And phone lines are finally open. My apologies for the extended conversation there, but I think some of it was, though it's not the usual material we cover in such detail, it's current city issue for those of you who do follow city politics and a perspective you're not going to hear much of, at least not out of the mouths of city council members, that's for sure. Let's catch a little music from Danielle. And then I will be back. You can call in at 427-3772.
I get squeamish in your presence. So fuck you for being present. I don't wanna think about you if you look so fucking stupid standing there. Overcooked, overdone, overworked over there. Over there you are. Stop making me uncomfortable. My skin is crawling away. I have nothing to say. I have no nerves. I'm such a jerk. Jack.
but you're a jerk off, so fuck off. I may be a jerk, but you're a jerk off, so fuck off. And I may be a jerk, but you're a jerk off, so fuck off. Yeah, yeah. Jerk, yeah. Get the fuck out of my face. Jerk, yeah. Don't wanna know you, I gotta lay down and rot. I gotta lay down and rot. Yeah, 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 yeah.
Sweet voice and outspoken sentiments from Danielle Savage. If it has limbs, it's probably useless. You're tuned to Free Radio 101.1 FM and www.freakradio.org. There was a demonstration at the town clock the day after the Raich versus Ashcroft U.S. Supreme Court 6-3 decision, which overturned a federal court decision which stated that patients could indeed medicate themselves and care providers could provide medication under the legal provisions of state law with the doctor's recommendations in California and 9 other states. And now it's not legal anywhere if you stand up before a federal official who wishes to shut you down or arrest you for simple possession of marijuana. This demonstration was quite a massive demonstration of the town clock, and this is some of what happened.
Well, it's about 15 to 6 on June 7th here at the town clock with the demonstration against the Supreme Court decision in Raich versus Ashcroft. We're talking with...
I call myself Quicksilver.
And Quicksilver, you came up to ask me, you know, what would happen if you... Dare I say it, lit a joint at an event like this, right?
Yeah, and a lot of people thought that was inappropriate, and I don't understand why. I asked them what the kind of reaction we would expect. Would the police come? I mean, so what?
No, the police wouldn't come. This, particularly if you have a card to medicate yourself, you're allowed to do that. And, you know, even if you're not, obviously, this is an abusive law that's been around for now 60-odd years with that marijuana prohibition, actually longer, but the federal prohibition has been since 1937. So, light up. That's my suggestion.
Right. Well, if the Republican Party wants to actually be the Republican Party, what they have to first do is condone the use of states' rights as a way of making this country... really the United States of America.
You said to me when you came up, you're referring, of course, to the Rehnquist-Thomas position that this is a state's right not to be, you know, have your house raided for private possession of medical marijuana, which is what the Supreme Court said now can be done by the feds, even if it's legal in the state and being used for medical purposes. But you were saying that rather than simply sit around and, you know, hope for legal changes or even stand up with signs and talk about legal changes. There was a point where you were radicalized or there was a radical movement that made more impact than this kind of protest?
No, I was talking about in the past, it started off with the civil rights and a war against Vietnam. And it started off as a kind of a love, free speech, you know, happiness and flowers in our hair. And that worked to a certain extent, but when we all got radical, that's when things really started to change. That's what the Black Panthers figured out. That's what the Weather Underground figured out. And I can't tell you any more about the Weather Underground and the fact
they paid quite a price for it.
They what?
Paid quite a price for it.
Yeah, a lot of them were killed. Yeah. 22 Black Panthers were murdered by Oakland police. I saw it.
Right.
I used to hang out in the Doggy Diner. I used to knew.
Are you going to light up a joint or you just sort of ponder it?
I didn't bring any with me because I didn't even know this was going on.
I haven't smelled any of the... I see tobacco being smoked, but I don't see marijuana. It's kind of strange.
That is ironic. That's
ironic. We've been talking with...
I just go by Quicksilver.
Sounds good. Thanks, Quicksilver.
No one remembers my name.
We're talking to another person who didn't know this was happening. Your name?
My name is...
Two pauses briefly, wondering about the federal penalties for giving one's name at such a rally.
My name's Hill. Hi, what's your name?
Hill. Hey, I drop over sometime. Well, no. So what do you think of this rally? I know it's beginning to wind down. Been here for about 45 minutes, I guess, it's been happening. And
What? It's very important. Where's our time capsule? We want to deposit ourselves on the Supreme Court steps in about 10, well, by tomorrow morning. Mm-hmm. So when they show up for work, we'll be there and, you know, tell them they must free the plants. Free our biological freedoms.
What about the city authorities of Santa Cruz who have, in essence, banned marijuana clubs for 5 years? Still do.
When's the next election?
November of 2006. By banned, I mean so severely restricted that there are no medical marijuana clubs and haven't been. WAM, as you know, is a closed group that, you know, essentially it's a cooperative.
I think it's a travesty. We've got to free the plants. I mean, people's health and well-being and pursuit of happiness should not be trampled on by politicians. It's not their job.
Of course, I don't see you lighting up any marijuana. Does that indicate a prudent attitude, a lack of money, or what does that mean?
I just don't normally carry it to work. It would be too tempting.
You have a card or a letter?
No. No,
you're under arrest. Take her into custody, officer.
See, that's another reason why I don't bring it to work. It's safely on my boat at the 200-mile limit, in case you know, want to come over sometime.
I'll be there later on if you keep a wave reserved for me. Thank you, Hill.
You're welcome.
To Jose. Jose, you got an RIP WAM member, Susan Davis, and I'm holding a RIP for Conrad Parades, who 1949 to 1990. Wow, I must have died even before WAM was formally... when did WAM form, you know?
When did it start, I think, in 96?
So he was... Wow. Well, that's interesting. He died 6 years before WAM formed.
Well, you know what? I don't really know. I've only been a member for, like, 5 years almost. Uh-huh. So, you know what I mean? WAM has been around longer, but I don't really know exactly dates.
I know Valley and others have been fighting for rights for medical marijuana users, and marijuana users, I would say, as well, you know, for a long time. But as I've been saying to everybody else in the crowd, WAM has also been unresponsive to concerns that here in Santa Cruz there is no legal club, but hasn't been for 5 years. Mm-hmm. And that's because of the law that was cooked up in the back room with council members consulting with WAM members. It's unfortunate.
Yeah,
I wasn't there, you weren't either, but
no,
that's what I heard.
Yeah, I don't know. I've only been, you know, I got sick with cancer and all that stuff, but look, I'm standing, you know. Mm-hmm. It sure helps, you know.
Okay.
It really does help. And, you know, it's kind of like really bad to try to take it away, you know what I mean? Because, I mean, it's somehow people still have to buy it somehow. So I think it's better for us to grow it ourselves. That way we just don't, no money involved. You know what I mean?
I think it's a great idea.
It's a medication, you know what I mean? It's like corn, you know what I mean? People plant corn, why? Because we need it to eat. So the same thing with this.
You shouldn't eat unless the Supreme Court says you can eat. So give it a few more years.
Yeah, but pretty soon I say, wait a minute, you can't eat this or that, you know? And this is, I mean, all the medications the doctor gave us, I mean, from, I mean, they're drugs.
Stay tuned.
The man holding up a picture of, a silhouette of Rosalind Morgan.
Formerly WAM member who has passed away along with 155 others of our group. And this is to let people know that this is a very serious organization and that many of our members, if not most of our members, are terminally ill. And that medical marijuana is very helpful for terminally ill patients. And this is a remembrance of all those that have passed.
How long have you been a WAMster? You're a WAMster yourself?
Yes, I'm a caregiver, and I've been part of the medical marijuana movement ever since the original marijuana club here in town, and had some involvement with the marijuana club that was up in San Francisco, too. But I'm very happy to see that the current paradigm of a collective is working well for us. Keeping as much of the profit margin out of it as possible seems to be the healthiest for patients.
How does decision-making work in WAM? I mean, do you have weekly meetings, monthly meetings, yearly meetings?
Well, we have weekly meetings, and many things are discussed, and many decisions happen by means of the board. We have a board of directors.
How many people are on the board?
You know, I don't exactly know that. A good deal of the decision-making in WAM is somewhat up to the people that wish to get involved, that many of us don't take as much of an active role in the day-to-day decision-making, but we all like to come out when there's a visible area like this to let our wishes be known.
Has there been any discussion of the criticism which I and others have had of WHIM that WHIM is, you know, good in terms of what it does, but the fact is that there's been no medical marijuana dispensary for 5 years in Santa Cruz due to a law cooked up in the back chambers with Fitzmaurice Rutkin and, I have to say, the corrals, which other care providers were not invited, which in essence has, in effect, screened out all clubs that have tried to apply and discouraged others from applying at all. And this is not to say that this is necessarily going to be the continuing situation. In fact, I've heard rumors that, not just rumors, I believe there's been a report that Valerie Corral has sent a letter to the mayor or the city council urging a change in the law. So that's positive. But has that subject ever come up in 5 years for discussion?
Oh, it's often discussed by WHAM members. We all are very interested in figuring ways that our help can be extended to others and that others can have the same benefits that we're fighting for. But I believe the reality of it is that we really don't have a heck of a lot of advantage by being WHAM. We just, it's the camaraderie and the friendship and the support with each other. But as far as legally, any individual in California does have the same rights and options. It's just that being part of a group helps you understand your situation more. And would that we could open up and have everyone in town, but we just are so limited by what we can do and who we can help that we have to draw the line somewhere as to how many people we can work with.
I understand any one group can't but deal with the people inside that group. But, you know, I mean, this was brought up at city council meeting a couple of weeks ago. WHAM distributes, for instance, in a forbidden area, but is ignored by the police and should be, as we all should be. But other clubs, like the Pacific Cannabis Cooperative, which was serving people downtown in another forbidden area, was closed down. Now, I attribute this to the connections WHAM has with politicians, and as well as its good reputation, which, you know, I shouldn't be gainsaid. It's certainly true.
Yes.
But the question is, you know, what about the 3,000 to 4,000 other people who have no access to medical marijuana?
It certainly,
you know, I'm not saying WHAM should provide access, but WHAM should certainly be standing up and saying, why is this city law, as apparently Valerie is now doing, she's right here, I can ask her.
Yes.
You know, I actually put in a call to her, so she'll need to get back to me.
Mm-hmm. But I'm sure that she, too, is very interested in helping as many people as we possibly can. I've heard her say many times that it makes her very sad to see people that we can't help and that we get so many phone calls and so many people visiting, wanting help, wanting to be involved, and we tell them all the information we can and to let them know, but we just have...
Yeah, no, I mean, I think there are plenty of people who would open clubs like, you know, Matt Hilliard and Peter Koch and other groups, but they can't because of what the city council's current ordinance is, and I'm glad to hear...
Well, for me, the whole thing is just such a case of absurdity built on absurdity, that by our original rights and the Constitution, the government has no business telling us what we take, and somehow we have messed up and given them the power to have dominion over our freedom. And I think that's where we all need to go back to, is that if the doctor says this is okay, the government should have nothing to say at all.
Who can dispute you, you know? And the question is, how can we as a group of citizens here in Santa Cruz and across the country bring this message home? We've had, what is it now, 70 years of marijuana prohibition federally and maybe 80 or 90 years before that?
Well, I have to at least mention the 800-pound elephant in the living room, that the pharmaceutical companies, the insurance companies, the corporations that are making so much money out of these outrageously overpriced and dangerous drugs are very concerned about losing a significant amount of their profits if marijuana were made available, because it does address so many things that are currently being paid, you know, very high prices for.
So, welcome. Any comments for Free Radio?
I love you.
Oh, okay, the signs are being picked up.
My way out the door. Wham, I gotta get it.
Give me a copy of your letter when you can. You wrote a letter to Rutkin.
Did Andrea pass it on to you?
No, but hopefully she will. I also left you a message. A quick summary.
This is Valerie Corral, a co-founder of WHAM, at the WHAM protest.
Supreme Court decision in Raich versus Ashcroft. We're talking with...
I call myself Quicksilver.
And Quicksilver, you're...
Or, ma'am, I gotta get it.
Give me a copy of your letter when you can. You wrote a letter to Rapkin.
Did Andrea pass it on to you?
No, but hopefully she will. I also left you a message. A quick summary as to what it says.
It says that the regulations are restrictive and not allowing people to open up to dispensaries to meet the needs of patients, and that it sort of puts WHAM into a position. It puts WHAM into a position that's unfortunate because we can't serve everyone. We can really only serve maybe a handful of the thousands of people in this community who need access. And there are courageous people who will open up dispensaries. I know there are.
Okay.
But, you know, I also think that there's a way that we should meet. In other words, what I think that what we need to do is eliminate divisiveness and meet and just be really forcefully, lovingly insistent. You know,
I'd love to see some of that loving insistence.
Yeah.
Loving insistence, you know, it's important. And it allows people to make the right decisions and encourages them to make the right decisions, which I really think this community wants to do.
Well, let me know if you hear of any positive impact from the loving insistence from the politicians.
I will. I'm actually just going to make some appointments so I can get an answer.
Cool.
I think it helps. Not just me getting the answer, but, you know, all of us. And it's something I think that needed to be done. It's been done verbally, but I think it needed to be written after the last closure.
Yeah, I think you can get a copy of Valerie's letter. No problem. You can get a copy of Valerie's letter by actually going to the library, where I think it's now available for the public just as part of the correspondence to the mayor.
That's how they do it?
That's what I was told by the city clerk. I haven't seen it yet. But, yeah.
Perfect. It should be available, and I can have it available. I can just get it to you, which is easier. I have your email, so I can pop it in and email it to you.
And maybe you might want to post
remind
it.
Me, well, did you leave me a message?
Yes.
Then I'll be reminding you.
If you want, post it on the website and let people know that, you know, and encourage other WHAM members to contact the mayor and say, you know, do something
perfect.
About this.
Perfect. I'll get my webmaster and ask her to put that up. I think that's important.
Yeah.
Good idea. I didn't even think of it. I don't really use our website for personal messages, but that's not a bad idea. Well, that isn't a personal message, this one. This is a political message.
A concern to the community.
Yeah.
And these times, it's particularly important. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Valerie.
Appreciate
it.
All right.
That's what I'm talking with. Yes, Gene Wills, caregiver for WHAM. And I just wanted to take a moment and thank you for all that you do as an alternative media champion. Thank you for being out there and giving us some other viewpoints. I get a little tired of Fox.
I'm pretty foxy myself. Thank you.
Thank you.
There are also a couple of council members, former council members, or former mayors here. As you might expect, there's former Mayor Christopher Crone, who was here with his children. I haven't seen him. Right. And then Mayor Mike Rapkin made a quick appearance and then disappearance. So crowd is beginning to thin now. People are sort of wandering away.
Mayor Mike Rutkin, quick to appear and disappear, perhaps because he doesn't want to discuss issues of medical marijuana inside the city limits of Santa Cruz. It's all very safe to discuss these issues vis-a-vis the feds or vis-a-vis the international situation or vis-a-vis even the state authorities. But when it comes to recognizing that your own laws are preventing people from getting medical marijuana, that's something that Rutkin has been unwilling to address in any meaningful, active way since he got into office, actually. In fact, he created the law that closed down the clubs. I have not received yet from Valerie Corral the email that she has promised me. It's only been a day and a half later, though, it's only been a day later. So it's 2 days later. But still, I'm hoping to check that out. As mentioned, the letter that Valerie Corral wrote to Mayor Rutkin, that I guess a copy of it was given to Andrea Tischler of the Compassion Flower Inn, should be available in the public library under Mayor's Correspondence, and I'm going to try to have it posted on the Internet. And I hope that she carries through on what she said was her inclination to post on the WHAM website the letter and urging other WHAM members to get in touch with city council members and tell them to get off the dime and change the laws so that people could open dispensaries. By the way, it's not the Pacific Cannabis Cooperative, it's the Pacific Coast Cooperative. My apologies to Matt Hilliard and Peter Koch. Tried to get an update from them earlier today. Well, was able to reach Peter, but as has been the case frequently, was in a meeting and promised to call me back. We'll see if he actually does. He hasn't called me back. And I'm still trying to get Valerie Corral to come on the show and talk about this issue in greater detail to clear up possibly some misunderstandings and possibly to encourage her to speak out more forcefully to city council members on this issue and encourage the people that listen to her to do the same. It's my belief that if she spoke out, there would be, and she seems to be beginning to speak out, but did so in no uncertain terms, there would be a real change in city council policy and a rewriting of these laws. The problem, of course, now is that even the long-delayed application for Greenways, which is a group that's applied for a medical marijuana dispensary permit in the Harvey West area, has now been put on hold pending the city attorney's review of Raich versus Ashcroft, the decision that came down on Monday, which criminalizes all dispensaries. I don't think that should stop us from supporting the constitutional rights of American citizens. If the Congress and the U.S. Supreme Court are propounding unconstitutional restrictions on the rights of individuals, it's up to the community to resist that kind of tyranny, and I think that's an important thing to do. In fact, on Sunday, when the show has another edition, a longer one, from 9:30 to 1 o'clock in the afternoon, you can hear jury nullification expert and jury historian Godfrey Lehman talk about the issue of how jury decisions have influenced legislative, executive, legal policy, public policy throughout history, throughout the history of both this country and some other countries as well. How important juries are in, and the decisions juries have in changing such things as slavery, addressing issues like free speech issues, the freedom of the press, and the Zenger decision, the right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. Religious freedom, as in William Penn's case when he was tried in England under in what's called the Bushell decision, where he was arrested for holding a Quaker service on the steps of a church when the only services that were allowed to be held were Anglican services under the Conventicle Act of 1670 in England. Anyway, Godfrey Lehman, 10:30 on Sunday. Tune in here at Free Radio, 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org. Then at 11:30, we're hoping to have Pebbles Trippett come back. She's a medical marijuana patients union activist from Humboldt, from Mendocino County. And she's been concerned with making sure that the city of Ukiah authorities don't take away the right of people to be able to grow marijuana in their own yards, care providers, patients, people who need a medical marijuana, and that apparently was put on hold for 45 days with an emergency concern that people were smelling marijuana and that somehow wasn't a good thing. The smell argument, interestingly enough. And we'll see what's been happening up in Ukiah and Mendocino County on that issue when she comes back. I'm also hoping to hear from Andrea Tischler, and she's actually got a selection here where I interviewed her Tuesday evening when that protest, the WHAM protest, was happening, and I'll be playing that on Sunday as well, since I've only got about 12 minutes left in the show and don't have any time to play the rest of it now. So I encourage you to tune into the Sunday show. It should be interesting. If you can't catch the Sunday show, it's archived at www.huffsantacruz.org, and then click on Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. You can actually hear the show. My apologies that there aren't clearer linear notes, so you can tell actually what you're going to be listening to. But if you tune to the date of the show, you should be able to get in there and hear what's been cooking. Let's see here. There's a couple things that are happening tomorrow. For those of you who like to follow and are concerned with civil rights for poor and homeless people, tomorrow at 11 a.m., Sharon Pate, will be appearing in Department 2 with attorney Tony Bowl defending her from a camping ticket. That's makes it illegal to sleep in the city of Santa Cruz after 11 o'clock at night. 11 o'clock, Department 2. I'll be there. Maybe you will, too. Downtown at the court building at 701 Ocean. I see that someone was trying to call in. I encourage you to try again. I'm going to be paying closer attention to the phone line, so call in, and you will, in fact, get on the air here in the last 11 minutes of the show. Also coming up tomorrow in court is a hearing of the Jerry Henry pretrial. That's the guy who was given a $25,000 bail after earlier getting a $50,000 bail, and even before that a $100,000 bail for a conspiracy to buy a cup of coffee. He's being charged under laws like interfering with a business because he stood outside a business after he was refused business there and advised people that he was being treated and like a second-class citizen, or as he put it, this poor nigga is not going to leave. As describing himself in the language of a person who had been discriminated against as ex-slaves, and slaves were discriminated against, and black people for hundreds of years. He's facing, I believe it's 11 charges propounded by a merchant police conspiracy. I would even say a merchant police DA conspiracy. And there's been some talk of there being a mediation proposal that will sort of substitute for the court process, which he's hoping will be initiated. The court, Heather Morse, or Make It Up As You Go Morse, as I call her, has refused the very eloquent defense arguments to dismiss these charges summarily. I see that, again, a phone call began but didn't conclude. Try again. See if we got an actual phone person here. No, nobody on the line yet. Call in, call back. I see that someone's calling in but is not staying on the line long enough for me to catch them. I've got to be able to both see what's cooking and at the same time lift my palsied hands to the appropriate buttons and get that done. So call in 427-3772 if you have any questions. Check out the Jerry Henry pretrial tomorrow. You have to check the court calendar to see what court it's under. And also the Sharon Pate trial. This will be a full-scale trial, not before a jury, but before a judge on the issue of camping. She was in her vehicle at the 24-hour fitness club where she is a paid-up member, and yet she was harassed for sleeping in her vehicle while she was parked there. Not by the management of the club, but by, I believe it was Officer RoboCop Perry, if I'm not mistaken. RoboCop is his sort of street name among homeless people who have so described his behavior. So, other things have been happening. For those of you who follow Democracy Now!, you may know that there's Patriot Act provisions are coming back. The Senate Intelligence Committee voted 11-4 to forward Patriot Act 2 provisions, which would make permanent 8 provisions currently set to expire at the end of the year, increase government surveillance by granting investigators access to individuals' business records and allowing wiretaps and searches without a demonstrated link to terrorism or a federal judge's permission. Has yet to be considered by the Senate Judiciary Committee, the full Senate, and the House, but considering the way it's going, could be one of them slam dunks. Last night, the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, or the Bill of Rights Diddledy-Doo Committee, as I used to call it, because it didn't mind taking positions on national issues, but didn't want to deal with the same kinds of concerns locally for fear of offending then-Mayor Kennedy. And as a consequence, it couldn't get any strong position by the city against the Patriot Act either. And never seemed to get very far, but there are some really concerned people who are working with that group, the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. And perhaps I'll have an update from them on Friday as well. You can go to democracynow.org and hear a kind of a preliminary debate on the Patriot Act, which is happening, or is archived there. Not terribly enlightening, but sort of interesting as a kickoff point. What's really interesting to me is the situation in Bolivia, which is growing graver by the hour. Here's a quick update from Luis Gomez on the Narcosphere, which is a website, narcosphere@.narconews.com. We said so a few hours ago at the congressional session in Sucre to consider President Carlos Mesa's resignation was not going to happen. A few minutes ago, Senator Ormando Vaca Diaz, president of the Congress, suspended all legislative work without any date or time given to resume it, faced with the situation in the Bolivian capital. This could be the end of Armando Vaca Diaz's political career. What's going on here is that masses of peasants, workers, miners, the people, in other words, have come to the capital to demand nationalization of the gas and oil industries and a real free election which dumps the calcified dinosaurs that are currently governing on behalf of the international corporate agencies in terms of the IMF and so forth. And so far, two presidents have resigned. Now they've got a right-winger, Senator Armando Vaca Diaz, who is a kind of a sympathizer, who is a right-wing military supporter. And according to the Narco News, the first confrontations have already begun in Sucre. The mine workers and students of Sucre are now combating the police near Plaza 25 de Mayo. The uniformed officers are responding with tear gas and bullets fired at those setting off dynamite. And while throughout the entire country hunger strikes grow against the possible presidency of Armando Vaca Diaz, he suspended the session and ran away to hide. And there's more. Here's from Al Giordano, who's the author of this website. It's 4:30 in the morning somewhere in a country called America. The coffee percolates on a lucky stove where there is still gas. Authentic journalism cannot sleep. A day of reckoning is upon us. Today, the ghosts of Bolivia's 180 years of simulated democracy will haunt the empty halls of the Bolivian Congress in La Paz at 10:30 a.m., as the senators and deputies of the disgraced official parties convene 740 kilometers away in Sucre. They can't convene on the capital because there's so many people there demanding that they take action. They're afraid to go there. In fact, I understand that the miners and peasants have taken over the airport and are stopping Congress members from leaving town, demanding they convene and order an election. By the dawn's early light, thousands of farmers, miners, students, teachers, manual laborers, maids, gardeners, elders, and children chewing coca leaf and carrying ancient memories and dreams of self-determination are moving towards Sucre, which is that other Bolivian city where the Congress has slipped away to. The legislators had to be flown to Sucre in military airplanes to pull the underhanded maneuver that is on today's docket, the installation of an unpopular, indeed reviled politician and oligarch, Armando Vaca Diaz, as illegitimate president. The blockades that have shut down 120 points along the country's roads and highways, those are peasant people's blockades, would not let these powerful men pass over by land. And yet this morning, in the darkness, the barricades have lifted in each town and hamlet along the path so that the common people, the majority owners of Bolivia, could pass towards Sucre on roads where the corrupt politicians could not. To the rooster's crow, the path opens. The pro-democracy pilgrims are handed cooked potatoes, fried bananas, maybe some fried trout, salteñas or chicharrón for sustenance along the way by a population that supports their cause. They ride on the backs of pickup trucks over dirt and gravel roads, past the oil fields they have occupied in recent days, the closed gas valves, the plugged water mains, the stranded trailer tractors filled with rotting produce, and the U.S.-funded military bases where poor indigenous young men worry about being sent to massacre their own in the coming days. And once the caravan passes through, the locals recover the roads with rocks, toppled trees, barricades, and banners. The battle has begun. There is no turning back. The Monday night resignation of President Carlos Mesa, a well-intentioned sap who could not reconcile his knowledge of Bolivian history with his oligarch roots and privilege, is just one more step on this long, seemingly endless march. Indecision has a first and last name in Bolivia, and it is Carlos Mesa. He tried to please everyone, the U.S. ambassador, the coca growers, the oil companies, the social movements, the official parties, the opposition, the oligarchs, the indigenous, and ended up pleasing nobody. He straddled that picket fence until his seat hurt so much that he had to jump off. Next in line for executive power in Bolivia, if Congress, as expected, ratifies Mesa's resignation, is Senate President Armando Vaca Diaz, an agribusinessman from Santa Cruz, not our Santa Cruz, but theirs, who owns vast tracts of land that he does not work with his own hands, while most of his fellow and sister citizens struggle to find and keep a home on a small plot that in most cases someone like Vaca Diaz claims to own. But Bolivia's Congress could not meet on Tuesday, nor on Wednesday. The men of wealth and power with legislative titles feared to tread in the administrative capital of La Paz this week because the masses had come down from the hills to put a stop to the simulation of democracy and to demand a real one. And so Vaca Diaz convoked the military to swoop up the legislators and fly them to Sucre, where they will meet this morning. According to a national public opinion poll taken this week by the daily La Razón in La Paz, 84% of the Bolivian people do not want Vaca Diaz to assume the presidency. But within that remaining 16% is Mr. Vaca Diaz himself. That's why he has gone to such lengths to move Congress to a faraway location in order to ratify his coronation. Vaca Diaz is not an indecisive man. He knows what he wants. Power, and he knows how to get it by any means necessary. Vaca Diaz, on the cusp of realizing his long presidential ambitions, revealed his doctrinal political power on Tuesday when he said the radicalism of the left leads to totalitarian governments. Vaca Diaz also told reporters, if one faction from the many social sectors chooses to set aside these principles of national unity and push us toward confrontation and a bloodbath, it will end in authoritarian government. It sounds like he was talking about the protesters, but the words apply more to his own faction. That group includes outgoing President Carlos Mesa, who took to the national airways on Tuesday night imploring Vaca Diaz to stand down, to not assume the presidency for the sake of the same national unity principle invoked by Vaca Diaz. Mesa said, Armando, as a person, as a politician, as someone who's known you for a long time, I make a personal plea to you, don't insist on going down a road that's impossible to follow. That group also includes, according to this week's survey data, the 55% of the Bolivian population that wants to see President Eduardo Rodriguez as their new president, who would call for new national elections within 3 months of taking office. And I'll be talking about more of this on Sunday. Events, I'm sure, are going to outstrip this whole story. So here's a quick phone call, which I just noticed. Sorry. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Is this Uncle Robert's radio show?
It is.
Hey, it's Uncle Jim.
Hey, Jim, you have about a minute to
talk.
Oh,
good. I just wanted to say I finally read Fred Gardner's article, and I thought it was a real piece of work.
I expect you to call back on Sunday with a full discussion. Actually, you've already talked about it somewhat.
Yeah, no, I thought I said I was going to call back tonight. I just didn't get to it.
Well, that's okay.
Sorry. So anyways, yeah, so everything's going good. We're going to have a little letter signing protest thing along Stevens Creek Boulevard this weekend. It's going to be fun.
Okay, how can people learn about this?
I'll put something up on the website later on tonight, area420.com.
Okay.
Or they could just call the number here. It's 246-0052.
Sounds good, and I wish we had more time, but we don't.
Okay, sorry. I'll call you Sunday.
No problem.
Bye.
Bye-bye. That's it for Bathroom Spears Broadsides. Check out and support a homeless person trying to defend herself, actually with the help of an attorney, pro bono lawyer Tony Bowles. That's going to be tomorrow at 11 o'clock in Department 2, and I'll be back on Sunday. You can see me at we're actually going to also be doing on Sunday a cop watch downtown. Police have been attempting to move away SAFE, Society of Artistic Freedom and Expression, musicians from in front of New Leaf Market using non-existent laws, interestingly enough. So we're going to kind of bring a little video equipment down there, bring a little audio equipment, bring some people. Check it out at 1 o'clock or 1:30 on Sunday afternoon. I'll be there. I hope you will, too.
Validating, I'll spin and it's there for the taking. If I'm not spinning, I'm wasting my time. And upon me to make you fine, I might have a few things to teach you soon. You never know what you could have come now with undone. Overcome it. I have it for I am. Can you see it's written in my plan? You may not understand, but in the dog and I sound still deliberate. In this deliverance, I'm convinced this is the way it's always been, and I'll get rid of it. position. I got no room for a position in this space. That's just the way it is. I have before I am. Can't you see it's written in my plan? You may not understand, but in the end I'll come out the bigger man. To the loss of will I fight. Keep the demons of reason on my side. I'm here to tell myself that my day will come. Oh, 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 oh. Yeah, yeah. Hey, Mr. Mr. Everybody can be. Which way you gonna set? I thought you'd never leave. You really got me in a bind. I had to pay the bill somehow. I played the part though oh so long. Forgot about now. I have it for I am. Can you see it's written in my plan? You may not understand, but in the end I'll come out the bigger man. To the loss I will abide. Keep the demons a reason on my side.
Be sure to wear Francisco. Gentle people with flowers in their hair. All across the nation, such a strange vibration.
Come and